Hey, welcome to the Millennial Movie Mix. I am one of your hosts, Justin, and with me as always is
Sarah,
Ashley,
and Kristen.
If you clicked on this podcast, you know that we are talking about the film Almost Famous.
From 2000.
That's right. It's our last sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Can you believe the summer's over?
No, it went by too fast.
It really did, always.
Yeah, I mean, because it was filled with sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
It's always a blur.
Yeah, it's just gone. Like, I think maybe I trashed a hotel room. I'm not quite sure. It's possible. All right, so Almost Famous is this film has always been with me. I mean, since it came out, you said it comes out in 2001. I am a junior in high school in 01. Depending on what year it comes out, I could have been like the end of my sophomore year, I guess. Because I graduated in 02. So it comes out when I'm in high school. And so just the idea of this high school kid traveling with these band members, it's pretty awesome. Again, this is my mom got this movie from, I don't know, Columbia House or somewhere. And so I've always seen it, always had it. Always, yeah, whatever. That's my nostalgia.
You got to watch all the things.
I got to watch all the things.
This was my first time watching it, and I would have been in first grade when it came out.
Yeah, this was also my first time.
Grade.
All right, so two first times.
I don't recall when I first saw this movie, but I do remember seeing it around the time that it came out. And, I mean, knew that it was a good movie, so.
Well, I mean, the cast blew up after the film. I mean, it's filled with people who just, like, chew the scenery. They're great acting, great character actors, and, like, leading actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got lots of people. Any standouts?
Zoe Deschanel, Kate Hudson.
Yes. New Girl herself.
Mm-hmm. Jason Lee.
Anna Paquin in there.
Anna Paquin.
Yeah.
I think that it's so important to note a piece of trivia about Anna Paquin.
What is it?
That, all right, so when Anna Paquin was, I don't remember how old she was. I mean, less than 12. I mean, 10 or something. You know, she's an Oscar winner.
Really?
She won an Oscar for the film The Piano with Holly Hunter and Harvey Keitel. And Anna Paquin is the first millennial to be nominated for an Oscar.
That's insane.
Yeah. So, like, I think that's just like I'm looking up trivia pieces and I'm like, jot that down.
It fits in perfectly.
It does fit in perfectly. And Anna Paquin, I mean, yeah, she plays Aphrodisia in this movie. But I mean, she is always now and forever going to be
Sookie.
Yeah.
Even though when I was younger, to me, Anna Paquin is Rogue.
Oh, yeah.
From the original X-Men series.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I ate that up when I was younger. So I knew who Anna Paquin was. And so, yeah, so she's just like this breeze that flies through the movie. Like, they have so many people like this, like Farrugia Balk.
Uh-huh.
She's from The Craft.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say Elaine, played by Frances McDormand.
McDormand, yeah.
She's Miss Clavel from Madeline.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, she is!
Now, see, I know her from her breakout hit in Fargo.
I still need to see Fargo.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Don't you know?
I don't think I've even seen
Fargo. And I need to see the Ewan McGregor reboot.
The television show, yeah. Kirsten Dunst is in that, too.
Really?
Yeah. Let's see. We were talking about, okay, so Farrugia Balk is also in Return to Oz. I wanted to point that out.
I love that movie.
Yeah, she plays Dorothy in Return to Oz. We've got Jimmy Fallon and Rainn Wilson.
Yes.
Who pop up in this. And then, of course, Jason Lee from Mallrats and like Kevin Smith fame. Also Dave in the Alvin the Chipmunks movies. So yeah, he's in this. He plays Jeff Beebe. All the way back when they were the Jeff Beebe band.
Oh my god.
What's interesting is that the star Patrick Fugit, who plays William, he didn't really shoot very far as a star.
No.
So this was like his movie. He did another one called Spun, I think, where he played like a meth head or something like that with Brittany Murphy. I think she's in that. But like, yeah, he didn't really go very far. Let's see. And I know, you know, we've got a bunch of other people here. I'm completely spacing on, you know, we didn't even talk about Russell or Penny.
Yeah, was in Watchmen and Rudderless. Those are the two things I've seen him in.
What did you say?
Watchmen and Rudderless.
Yeah, he is in Watchmen.
Yes.
I can't believe I'm totally spacing on his name, and I didn't even, like, write it down anywhere. Because, like, I'm like, certainly I'm going to remember the actor who plays him. Because I think that he was,
Was it Rorschach?
No.
Or was it,
He didn't play Rorschach. But, And then Kate Hudson plays Penny Lane. And she's like in How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
She's in all kinds of
Skeleton Key. She blew up.
Yeah.
But I can't believe I'm spacing on Russell Guy's real name. We'll just call him Russell.
It's Billy Crudup or something.
Yeah, Billy Crudup. Thank you for the quick internet accessibility I can't have with my phone.
It's fine. I got you.
Yeah.
Did we say Jason Lee is Syndrome and The Incredibles?
Yeah. You caught me monologuing.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
No, he's not.
Yeah.
Yes.
I fucking love that movie.
It's so good.
That is a good one. All right. So this is done. This film is done by Cameron Crowe, and it is semi-autobiographical. That's a butchering of that. And this dude is also the guy who writes and directs Jerry Maguire with Tom Cruise. You guys heard of that movie?
I've heard of it. I know nothing about it.
Show Me the Money.
You've not seen it.
You've never seen You Had Me at Hello, Jerry Maguire.
No.
There was a song on the radio with bits of this movie in the song for Jerry Maguire. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah. I loved it.
It was huge.
It was hugely popular. Huge.
And so he does Almost Famous, and it is I think not exactly a giant success, but it becomes like a cult success later. And especially with all of the people who skyrocket, it's a respected film, but it didn't really get a lot of love in the movie theaters.
Yeah.
All right. We can't talk about this movie until we talk about triggers for the movie.
Oh my gosh, how could we forget about triggers for this movie?
Are there triggers for this movie? Were there triggers in the 70s?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh. Okay, all right.
All right, we've got strict parents and crazy moms, underage drinking, substance use, sexual assault, parents picking favorites, sexual predators, statutory rape, / human trafficking. Objectifying women, rock and roll. Overdose.
Rock and roll. Fuck.
There's a Confederate flag in there. It's in the background at the airport. Sexism and being used. And I have the human trafficking in there as I forget who it was. It was, I think, the guitarist. They were they traded girls for a case of beer and
$50.
They had to like change the course of where they were going.
Just, yeah,
wasn't like the manager or something. Their
manager. The managers were. Yeah, that was like a strange prostitution, but yeah, almost like a. I don't want to disrespect human trafficking, but like it's be like they weren't being forced to go. But yeah, that's definitely something that's shady and was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's just yeah, I didn't think about it as a human trafficking thing.
Yeah, it's a real gray area. But I figured I'd throw that in there because you shouldn't be traded to anybody for a case of beer.
Right. That's right. No, you shouldn't be traded to anybody. Period.
No.
It always kills me when we like rock and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's our title of the summer, and like rock and roll has been a trigger, and sex and drugs have been a trigger in every single movie that we've done.
Yep.
Like you are triggered by our theme. Then beware.
Beware.
If
this is your daily hate, thank you.
So, I mean, hopefully if you're clicking on the movie, you've watched it. Or if you haven't, you can pause and go watch it and come back. Or do both and have a really good experience. Come back and listen to us again. But here we go. Let's talk about Almost Famous.
In 1969, child prodigy William Miller struggles to fit in. His life is further complicated after learning that his widowed college professor mother, Elaine, has falsely led him to believe that he is 12 years old. William is actually 11, having started the first grade at 5 years old and skipping fifth grade. Strong-willed Elaine's strict ban on rock music and her fear of pop culture have a negative effect on her children, finally driving William's 18-year-old sister, Anita, to move to San Francisco and become a flight attendant. She leaves behind a collection of rock albums to inspire William.
The opening credits were really cute and creative, and I loved them. Yeah. I think they were some of my favorite ones ever.
Yeah, it didn't make it bad to watch. It felt like the art was already beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I liked it a lot.
I felt so bad for this girl that was just walking in trying to listen to some good music, and her mom was like, no, that is not allowed.
Well, wasn't it Simon and Garfunkel?
It was Simon and Garfunkel. let's not get any ideas from Simon and Garfunkel.
Didn't Simon and Garfunkel sing the song called The Rock?
The Rock?
I don't.
Yeah, some Rock. That's okay. That's beyond millennial knowledge. Yeah. That is, yeah. I know who Simon and Garfunkel is. Like I know who that band, that group. This and all of the other, that when they're flipping through those records, I mean it's really amazing. But I got the really good feeling as soon as they started playing the Chipmunk Christmas song. that just takes me back to being a kid. I was a kid in 1984, and so like then I think, oh my god, how long have the Chipmunks been around?
Yeah, that's definitely like synonymous with Christmas music now. I mean, like hearing that.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was super sweet that Anita left behind her records for her brother. Mm-hmm. Like that was just such a sweet little way to inspire him.
Tells him to burn the candle, right?
Yeah, burn the candle. Yeah. But, like, just his shock and horror to find out that he was actually
11?
Younger
than 11. 11?
Yeah. And I love the family's definitely basically at a toll because this mother is something.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids have gone through it. I love when she says, feck you.
Feck you.
You.
What's the difference?
The
letter U.
And then when Anita's finally leaving and William is talking to the boyfriend and is like, take care of her, man. And he's trying to talk to him all cool-like. And then it makes me sad that the guy's just such a jerk, and then Anita drives off with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, like, that sucks immediately.
Yeah, she's like doing whatever she can to escape that life. Yeah, is the issue.
Yeah,
she's not paying attention mm-hmm. to. But I mean, that Christmas in September. I mean, this mother is, I mean,
crazy.
We just had a real crazy one in Detroit Rock City, remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I feel like, and even as we go through the course of the movie, I like Elaine. She's wrong. Mm-hmm. But like, her heart's in a good place. But I also don't know if like she is used well in the movie, because even though she's wrong and she's done like some bad parenting stuff, I still enjoy the scenes that she's in.
Yeah, I mean, I still enjoy her character and I enjoy what she brings to the film.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, her parenting style is fucked up.
It's fecked up.
It's fecked up.
It's the classic anti-rock and roll mom stereotype.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and then, like, the difference between the way she raises her daughter and her son is not okay with me. Mm-hmm. That's not acceptable.
But also the level of control she's trying to have over their lives.
Yes.
Like going to the extent of lying about how old he is.
Right.
I mean, that's some messed up stuff. It's fecked up.
Yeah.
It's very fecked up.
Yeah, just to do what she thinks is best for him. But then, yeah, that is ultimately control. And, like, in Anita, there's this point where she says, like, William hates you. He's like, I don't hate her. And it's like this, like, it pits them against one another because Anita feels alone. And then William doesn't understand because he didn't get the same treatment. Mm-hmm. Like, he did get the same treatment, but
well, he's in a different way. He's not old enough to realize it yet.
Yeah.
And being, like, having the mother-son relationship, mm-hmm. I mean, that would add to like him not realizing how toxic of a relationship that is.
Because there is like no tea, no shade, no sexism. There is a real big difference between raising a boy and raising a girl, mm-hmm. I think. And especially when you have them together, and girls are very wild and willful. Like, girls are, like, I feel like that's why society has always kept, like, girls down.
Girls down, yeah.
Because guys are like, home? Okay. Like, for the most part. Mm-hmm. Like, they want to fight each other and they be like, you know, boom, boom.
Assertive, but like, and whatever. But for most part, like, autopilot.
Mm-hmm.
Girls are like,
driven and
always on. Like, on switch, always on.
I don't know. What do you think, 95ers?
I would agree. I think that women, like, analyze things more than men do. Like, I feel like we think about it more sometimes. That's in some instances. Not all the time. Because there's always exceptions to everything. But
of course.
I think that there's a big difference in the way that, like, boys and girls are socialized. And so, like, especially back in the 70s, like, the constant mm-hmm. putting girls in a box makes us mm-hmm. want to not be in that box really hard. And you, it's mm-hmm. like, nope, we're defiant. Getting out of this box. Here we come.
Yeah, which would explain why Anita fights so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She won't be boxed. So but I think then William doesn't see a danger in the box he's in until he wants out of the box.
Yeah, until he has an experience outside of the box.
But Anita never wants the box, like, never wants to be in the box.
Yeah.
But you're right, it definitely is a societal shaping type thing. It's why you can't really talk about the sexes, like, here's something for a guy and something for a girl, because it all is, like, it's nature nurture for everything. And then, like, mm-hmm. I guess you have to put societal influence and cultural impact into the nurture part. I don't know, but that definitely plays a huge role in no matter what gender you are. But still, in the case of the kids that I'm raising, my son is very docile, and and Ellie is the daughter is very she's fire. She is fire. But it's awesome. It's great. And just when she burns others, it's going to be even better.
Yes.
Don't just, burn me.
Definitely different between like the raising one and the other.
Yeah. But this daughter, Anita, gets out and she leaves. I love this. She wants to open her brother's mind, so she leaves him music.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Poetry. That's today's poetry.
Yes.
In 1973, William, now 15, aspires to be a rock journalist, writing freelance articles for underground papers in San Diego. Rock journalist Lester Bangs, impressed with William's writing, gives him a $35 assignment to review a Black Sabbath concert. William is barred from backstage until the opening band Stillwater arrives, and William flatters his way in. Lead guitarist Russell Hammond takes a liking to him and his new acquaintance, veteran groupie Penny Lane, who has taken William under her wing. Despite behaving as a stereotypical groupie, Penny Lane insists that she and her friends are band-aids, a term she invented to describe female fans that are there more for the music than for the rock stars themselves.
All right, so so much acting and like stuff pops up in this section.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where do we want to start? Like, at the beginning, or where are we going?
I have a little bit of historical context.
Okay.
So Cream Magazine was a real magazine from 1969 to 1989. I don't know if you guys knew that.
Uh-huh.
But then, so it's based on, so this movie's like historical to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And Stillwater was based off of a few bands that the writer William followed around. So it was like, I'm trying to remember who it was, the combination of
Bad Company and the Eagles.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And a little Todd Rundgren. Hello, yeah. It's me. Yeah. And Penny Lane is based on B.B. Buell, who is the mother of Liv Tyler. So the Liv Tyler's dad is
Steven Tyler.
A little son-in-law.
I thought we were going to see Sabbath for a second, though, and I was like, "What?
No, no, no." Ashley, I love that you found that because yeah, Cameron Crowe is the basis for William, and then he was like, "Okay, these are the people who I observed," and then he wrote them into the film. And so, yeah, I mean, the Eagles were huge. I mean, I remember that the Eagles were, like, the first, like, VHS tape concert. Like, I don't know why that, like, my family owned it or something. But, like, they made a concert and put it out on tape. And I just thought that was really strange of an artist to do. And then, of course, I mean, Bad Company. They have, in order for everyone to remember your band name, you make a song that's the exact same.
Mm-hmm.
So I the Lester Bangs character,
uh-huh,
with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
Lester Bangs, he real guy.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about like historical fiction. I mean, I'm almost positive. Yeah.
Interwoven in there.
Yeah, yeah. And then he has the quote about an industry of cool.
An
industry of cool.
And I think that is just, that's like TikTok today, you know, social media influence, keeping up with the Kardashians.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the idea from what rock and roll when you have Beatles, Elvis, mania, to then like people throwing panties on stage. You know, and animal cruelty, rock with makeup everywhere. Now, that is moved into other facets of life. I mean, hell, I can remember, like, you've got Bill Clinton running for president, going on talk shows, playing a saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was never before seen.
Yeah, that was, like, so sensational.
Like, the celebrity. Like, an industry of cool, it's not just rock and roll anymore. Like, there's almost an industry of cool anywhere. Like hell, like, and even, like, in teaching professions, like, you go to conferences, and there are people who have Twitter and their teacher talks and all of this stuff, and just trying to network and collect the most
and stay on top of it all.
Exactly. For an industry of cool. I kind of took it and moved it elsewhere. But I mean, I just really like that when they're talking about and they're back and forth and he's like, I know cool and you're not cool.
Yeah. It was pointed out multiple times how uncool he is.
I don't know what the point of that was, like letting him know or like kept telling the audience because like we're watching this, like are we ever watching it thinking that he is cool? So they keep reminding us, nope, remember he's not cool.
I think it's a total setup for him to be as completely uncool as he can possibly be and like have this like rising level of coolness.
Because they pushed him down. Yeah, I have to admit that the quote in the film I took into the real world when I was, I don't know, my sister is only like 6 years younger than me, but there was this point in time where I had to drop her off at school and I might have been in college or going like home for a break or something and I really wouldn't want to, or I don't know what it was, but she gets out of the car in junior high and I roll down the window and I'm like, don't do drugs. And
true big brother fashion.
I definitely love that line in this movie, and everybody in who's the parking lot like turns and starts like yelling, don't do drugs. And yeah, it was great. I love we're only in the second section of talking about the movie, but like every bit of it is entertaining. You're keeping up with it. You keep being introduced to different people, so it's not boring. Like it's a travel. It's almost like this epic journey of William and all of these characters he meets on the way and the lessons that each one of them teaches him about life and about humanity.
I never thought he was uncool. I just thought he was young.
Yeah.
He's just awkward.
Yeah.
He's 15.
Yeah. He's 15 hanging out with 20-somethings or so while they're intoxicated.
That's right. So we're going to go ahead and seg right into the awkward because it's hard to talk about this film because Penny Lane is 16. Yeah. Penny Lane is 16. And I know Kate Hudson's not underage when she's filming this movie. But still, like, you're supposed to be watching, like, the movie being like, okay, she should be in school. But then you're thinking, okay, it's the 70s. But no, we saw Dazed and Confused. We fucking know people went to high school, you know? Like, we know that about the goddamn 70s, even if we weren't fucking there.
But, so like, not like, only was she 16 and touring now, but they knew her from the year before.
Oh, my God, yes. Yes.
So, and like,
it's not going to be a party like it was. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be able to hide my dislike for Russell throughout the rest of the podcast.
No.
Yeah.
I don't know that there is a character who I dislike in a movie more than Russell.
Oh, yeah? That's a pretty big...
Well, I don't know. There are probably others. I really hate what he does to William, how he treats William and Penny Lane. I mean, the kind of guy who Russell is like fucking annoying. I'm triggered by you.
Do you hate him more than Nurse Ratched?
Yes.
Oh,
yes. I have more sympathy for Nurse Ratched. Of course. Of course I do. What you're talking about, Nurse Ratched was, it's a whole completely different, we can't talk about that in this podcast, Ashley.
No. Too triggering.
It's triggering. That's a whole different podcast. Wait till next Monday. We'll have a Nurse Ratched special. But yeah. So, I mean, we got to get right out of the way I'm going to be biased towards Russell because I think he's just a really crap individual type person. I totally like Jeff Beebe better than Russell.
Yeah. Well, Russell's very self-absorbed and
yeah.
only thing.
And
about
the fact that we've got a, that Penny Lane is underage, and there's nothing that we can do about that. So everything we talk about is also going to be, like, I guess, tainted by that. Like, we're not forgetting that she's underage.
Right.
Like,
and I cannot wait to talk about.
What's up, Ashley?
I am gonna be so fired up at the end of this too.
Woo. Okay. We will explode. All right. So then we have the Band-Aids, and we have to get through the uncomfortable their philosophy of no sex.
Was it just
blowjobs.
Just blowjobs.
But I mean, then like throughout the rest of the film, you hear the way they talk, and like I really like Sapphire in the movie, who's Fairuza Balk. She's the one who's in the limo and from with Sabbath.
Yeah,
and then pops back out. When they're talking about the love of the music, these Band-Aids truly are there for the love of the music. And later on, Penny Lane is going to say that Russell is her last project. So, like, I don't know if we're supposed to think that, I mean, that Penny Lane is an empowered woman, but she's not, because we see the rest of the movie. Mm-hmm. But she thinks she's in some sort of control.
Yeah. In fact, she's still like a child.
Yeah, because she's wrapped up in the world.
And she can't see beyond anything that's just like right there.
But then you have all of these other people who are following her mentality like a cult. And you're like, yeah, she was 15 when she thought of that. And that's a scary thing in itself. Mm-hmm. Like dumbasses leading dumbasses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's humanity.
I was really surprised when we find out she has an actual home at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, like, people that think and act like that a lot of times don't have a home to go back to.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, what her situation was like. I kind of, like, maybe if she has, like, really older parents.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe she, but never talks about siblings, never talks about anything, only talks about Morocco.
Morocco.
Yeah, that's I think that he meets the Band-Aids, and then I don't even know that he's gotten into the concert yet.
He gets in like right after by like talking to the band, and then Penny says that he's cool.
Oh, okay, yeah. And then they talk about, and then they go back out after, and they have the family whistle.
Yeah, they call him the enemy. And they call him the enemy because he's depressed. Then they find out that he actually, you know, knows and cares about them.
So he's they're like, well, don't maybe. Stop there. Come on.
Yeah, come on.
I love it. And we were talking, because it's been sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We've been talking about movies that have great songs. This movie, like, killer. Mm-hmm. Cameron Crowe is married to, oh my fucking God, what is her name? The lead singer of Heart. And they wrote these songs together.
Oh my God.
For the movie.
Ooh,
and so all so of cool. the different songs that Fever Dog, Ann Wilson of Heart, I think is who it is. And so all of these songs they sat down and they wrote, and then years later they're like, okay, let's use them in this movie then. And so I love the song Fever Dog.
Yeah.
It's so authentic. And just like the look of the stage, the way they shot everything, the way that Jason Lee, I mean, one, the costumes, everything technical on this film is amazing.
Yeah. It really goes into making the whole movie like kind of a seamless look back at how this life would have been.
Yeah.
And so the whole experience of Fever Dog and being at that concert, you kind of feel that with William in that moment.
Yeah.
And what is this the I don't know if this is the time where she takes his pencil and like throws it. And like, cause he's like trying to write about the, cause there are parts where he's trying to write about the music. He's trying to be so technical about it. And she's just like, you need to just like feel it basically.
Right.
Yeah.
I really like that. She gets rid of that, but I don't know if that happens in this section or another. Yeah.
Rolling Stone editor Ben Fong Torres hires William to write an article about Stillwater based on his skills and sends him on the road with the band. William interviews the other band members, but Russell repeatedly puts him off. Tensions between Russell and lead singer Jeff Beebe soon become evident and not helped at all by the band's first t-shirt, a full band shot that pictures Russell in full view while the rest of the band is unclear. William is jokingly called the enemy by the band as he is a journalist, but all the same begins to lose his objectivity as he becomes integrated into their inner circle.
So Anna Paquin's character, Polexia, comes up to William at a party, the one that he and Penny go to together.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you're her excuse for being here. I told you I'm not a fan of Russell, but I'm really not a fan of Penny in this movie.
No, me either.
And it's completely awful that, I mean, both of these characters, and I guess they have no moral responsibility to care about William. And because we're the audience and he's our main character, we kind of care about him. But you get a window into this world of like hedonism almost, like in this like Dionysian, they're only seeing something so carnal. And they don't care what they're crashing around them to get it.
Right.
And it's the game. And I love that Polexia does that. Like, she's like, what, like act one, where he pretends not to notice her. And like act two,
kind of explained
and she pretends to not notice him. And it's like all of this, like we're seeing it with these two people, knowing that that happens with, I mean, with so many, not even just in that rock and roll world of, and then you have the third wheel who just kind of gets left out. Poor William.
Yeah, no kidding. Do you guys know about the Riot House where everybody met up?
Yeah, the famous hotel.
Yeah, the Riot Hyatt.
Yeah.
The Who, the Stones, and Zeppelin all had famous legendary parties there. Lots of destroyed property, things going out windows, things like that.
And that is what Rainn Wilson tried to recreate in The Rocker. We talked exactly about that on that podcast. That way of life. All I remember that one time they don't let's see, Penny Lane uses the term the name Emily Rugburn as the fake name.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And does Stillwater use Houdini?
Yeah, Harry Houdini.
Harry Houdini. Yeah, in order to, I mean, how incredible would it be, or would it have been in that time? You know, you don't know shit about the future, so you just do whatever and just like follow those bands around. That would be amazing. I don't think that I would have wanted to, but my straight-laced anxiety would have been like, stay inside the lines. I wouldn't have let me, but I would have loved like
to follow
party at the Riot House.
Not for as long as they do in this movie. Maybe like for one or two parties.
It's old. Yeah. These people are doing it every single year. It's like eventually, like you're thinking like the Polexia character, like Fruza Volk, like she's going to be like that 70-year-old rocker chick woman who still walks around dressed like it's 1978 because you can't give it up. All right, so we have them get hired, and he's only 16 years old. And so he has to put on this fake deep voice, and his mom gets on the phone and tells him to do that thing to call the seat or whatever.
Yeah, but first he says, is this William so-and-so? I can't remember his last name. yes, it is.
Yeah. And it's just funny. It's a neat trick. It's classic. I don't quite know what you would call that kind of turnaround, you know, where the audience is in on the joke that.
Oh yeah, I don't know what you call that, but yeah.
But I enjoyed that, and just the pause of William's face when he's thinking like, "Am I caught? Am I caught?" Mm-hmm. And then Ben Fong Torres just goes along with it.
I know. I was like, he's totally not going to buy this. Oh, yeah. No, he bought it.
It worked.
Roll for persuasion.
Yeah, exactly. Nat 20.
Well, so first he didn't roll so great, but then with his bardic inspiration.
Time. You have the t-shirts where you have just some fuzzy guys and the out of focus guys in the background. And he says, like, you love this shirt because it says everything you want to say.
That, I thought that was going to be the end of traveling with the band.
Yeah. Like, done. Shortest journalist trip ever. Done.
But instead, we got to see a really cool party with a really high man.
Yeah. I'm a golden god.
Well, I'd say that's very familiar because, again, the rocker stole that.
It's perfect.
You know, it's this whole thing when they are going to this party, it's about, like, being real. Like, this is a real house. This is a real... And Russell is very obsessed with the idea of something that's real only because he thinks he's above it. Like, he's wanting to act like it's been so long or it's so out of distance to have something that is grounded and authentic because he actually believes that he's a golden god. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not just saying that to be funny. He's actually believing that he's a golden god.
Yeah.
And then he turns on William so viciously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for what reason? I mean, no reason.
Well, then, like, physically attacks him, too. And Dick has to pull him off. Dick is the road manager, right? He's the guy who karate fights the... Remember when Russell gets electrocuted and they have to run out?
Yeah, that's bad.
It's Noah Taylor, right?
Noah Taylor, yeah. And he karate fights the stage guy who's trying to come after them because they're leaving their set early.
Karate chop!
And that's when Sapphire has to run to catch up with them and she runs into the wall.
Oh my god, I fucking died. I fucking died at that part.
The summary doesn't, like, talk about all of the little nuances. Like, every single conversation that William's mother has with anyone. And they're just like, your mom, she's the
kind of freaked
work.
Me out.
Yeah. She's something. No. She kind of freaked me out. Yeah.
Your mom kind of freaked me out.
And when they talk about Beth from Denver, Your aura is green. And she's got some... Oh, and then when Sapphire picks up the phone and she's like, are you Marianne with the pot?
Yeah. I liked it when they left him at the gas station and he's like, I'm only
a singer. Sarah, yes, I fucking love that part. I'm only the lead singer. I like the, you know, this is the kind of movie where you know they had a good time filming it too. Because they needed that camaraderie to show on the screen. And I think that's a testament to how good of actors these people were. Because one, I totally believed that they were in the 70s. Like, they were those parts. And then how they played off one another. I mean, I don't know. I'm really digging the movie. Even though there are characters I strongly like dislike. I'm really digging the movie. Mm-hmm. And just for all of the small, I mean, this is when they go to the party and he has the outburst and they get back on that bus. My God, that tiny dancer movie scene.
Oh,
I don't know that there are better. I mean, that's a top scene in all movies, I feel like.
The ensemble was really, really good for this. And I was like, how are they going to come back from that really big fight? And of course, it had to be music.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like, no one said anything on screen, but you know, later they were just like, yeah, we're cool.
Well, yeah, because that's what it bonds them together. And like, you have this outburst, you release all of this energy. And then you fill yourself up with this new energy. And I mean, what is it? Music makes the people come together. I mean, didn't Madonna say that?
Mm-hmm.
You gotta believe. But this movie, I remember it brought like Tiny Dancer, I think, back into the stratosphere of music entertainment. Like, because they chose to put this, that film or that piece of music in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get it wrapped up with the catharsis that the characters go through. I don't know. I remember watching this in 2001 and then all of the time ever. And it's one of my favorite parts in the entire movie.
Yeah. I've always liked that song. I mean,
well, it highlights the power of music, exactly what Ashley said. I mean, and that's an Almost Famous is a love letter to music. So I think it's really fitting that it keeps showcasing what music does. And people keep talking about the power of music. I mean, this is also where he keeps saying, I need to get home. I need to get home. And Penny says, you are home.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because Russell keeps evading the interview. And they're just living this lifestyle, and William's trying to write about the lifestyle, not realizing that he's missing observing the lifestyle and mm-hmm. getting wrapped up in it. And I mean, they almost grab him. I think that if he was there not for Rolling Stone, he could have gotten lost in it.
Yeah.
I think he would have.
Probably.
His mom wasn't grounding him. So what else would have been there to ground him?
Yeah, like she surprisingly was just like, okay, I mean, I'm talking to you on the phone. I'm not requiring you to come home.
And I think it's because of Anita. She lost her daughter
mm-hmm.
and couldn't do anything about it.
Trying to take a different approach.
Exactly. I think she was terrified that if she held on too strongly, she'd lose William too. So she let go. And then you've got to see her anxiety throughout. What did she said? Rock stars have kidnapped my son.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yes.
She walks what out are of the class.
Yeah.
Like, what's she supposed to be a teacher of?
I think, I don't know English. If she teaches humanities.
I thought it was English.
Was it English?
Or literature. She was like a literature professor, right?
Well, I mean, she was talking about To Kill a Mockingbird. I don't know.
If she's a lit teacher, that makes no sense because, like, stereotypically, lit teachers are like pretty liberal in like their thinking and like what they think people should do. So, like, I don't know. Why did you treat your daughter like that?
I mean, yeah, she seemed it was like a strange kind of liberal thinking. Like, definitely, I don't think I would call her conservative. But it was strange about the music, but there is something to be said about the influence that music does have. I just, yeah, it's almost, when you break it down, it is almost doesn't make sense with the character. Like, she seems to, yeah, contradict. I mean, now, mm-hmm. when you think about it more, about what she would be for and against and how she would raise her kids. But then you think about how people are not always like you see, and she has to learn and grow. And Anita is the product of her learning to parent and Elaine learning to be a human. at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then you get then William, who is younger. So then he benefits from learning from the mistakes and then learning, you know, who you are when you have a kid at one age is not who you are when you have a kid at another age.
Right.
Not just in the parenting realm, but in the where you are on the human being scale of life. So then maybe you're also seeing like realism. And it's not contradictory, or it's contradictory because life is contradictory. I mean, I used to not like cottage cheese. I grew old and I'll eat it now. You know, like, I'll eat it now. It's not my favorite thing.
Now let's take a break and hear about our sponsor. And now back to the show.
The record label hires Dennis, a professional manager, to handle problems with venues and promoters. Penny has to leave before the band reaches New York, where Russell's girlfriend Leslie will join them. Penny and her three protege band-aids are gambled away to another band in a poker game. Penny acts nonchalant but is devastated. Meanwhile, Dennis charters a small plane so the band can play more gigs. Penny shows up uninvited at the New York restaurant where they are celebrating the news that the band is to be featured on the cover of Rolling Stone. Penny's asked to leave after Leslie notices her attempts to get Russell's attention. William chases her to the hotel where he saves her from an overdosing on Quaaludes.
Okay. I can't move forward without getting this off my chest. I'm pissed that the only semi-romantic movie in this, or semi-romantic moment in this movie is when the girl is intoxicated.
Oh my god, I know.
Yeah.
I did not remember that that's how that happened. And let me tell you how, like, I feel like it stains the movie.
Yeah.
I was like, I love this movie. And then I was like, what the actual fuck? She overdosed on codes and you're just like, you're just gonna like kiss her? And like, that's gonna be that?
Well, and no. It's also the whole, it's culture, because they make this fucking moment in the movie where she's vomiting up her guts and they're playing My Sherry Amour and he's like watching her feet and ankles and he's smiling at how beautiful she is and it's like, what the actual fuck?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That is not a beautiful moment.
A moment where it's not meant to be done.
No.
And like then I take a step back and it's like, okay, but if you really love someone, you love them at their worst, but then like...
I think that's what they were trying to do and they failed.
Yeah, because it came off as creepy, especially after he had just like he kisses her for the first time when she is drugged.
Yeah.
And like that is just... I mean,
creepy.
It's a product of the time. And that's not an excuse. It's just a fact. Mm-hmm. That in the 70s, they didn't fucking care. And even in 01, when they made this movie, they weren't fucking thinking about that. He was still your protagonist. You still were on his side. And
this wasn't seen by them as like something that was distasteful.
Exactly. And that's
And that's a problem in itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So problematic. No,
I don't even understand. I don't understand how they could sit there and be like, that's a good idea. Even like today, the actors would be like, what are we doing? Oh, what's the point of this? Oh, I'm passed out and he's the hero. It doesn't make any sense.
No. In 2001, when you saw this movie as a junior, what did you think of that?
I don't remember that. What did the
audience think? Yeah, like, how did he?
I didn't either.
Because in my mind, I'm probably thinking something about like how scary it would be or something along those lines of just being with someone you like. Or I'm not thinking about it at all. Or maybe I think it's wrong and I just like blurted out or something. Because I honestly didn't remember that happened.
Well, in so many movies, it was and probably still is a theme that like you fall in love with your savior, you know, like somebody who saves you, you immediately have this attraction to, and you're supposed to be with them. And that's like what I feel like in this moment.
Or this idea that if you are a good guy 99% of the time, then you get to like do bad 1% and it's okay. Like you're supposed to like, see how William is so respectful in all other aspects. He only date raped once.
Ugh.
You know?
Oh my God.
And it's like, so, no. Like,
if I was, I have pumped people's stomachs before. If I was pumping somebody's stomach and there was that motherfucker was looking at them like that, I'd be like, get out of the room. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What the and I would be very suspicious. Like, he why are you moment. Smiling like that? Like, no, no.
He was feeling like, her oats.
You called her, you called for help. You sit her up or lay her on her side and you just wait. And then
well, yeah, by the way, we're getting lost because of the sexism and all of that. But like, how? What are the fucking days where you have an overdose in a hotel and there's a doctor in the hotel automatically?
Right.
To come with and not take an you NG to the tube. Hospital. What?
With an NG tube ready exactly. to pump your stomach.
And like, is that a nurse who is just staying in the hotel too? Or like, the hotel has an on staff?
Doctor and nurse.
Doctor and nurse for OD.
You never know. That,
I don't,
that would
I don't
not
know.
Be it surprising.
Is, Party Rockin' Hotel. All right. So you, this is the selling the girls,
mm-hmm.
and he tells Penny that that's what she gets sold for, and then she asks what kind of beer.
Yeah.
And she does that, like, that look. I mean, Kate Hudson is amazing in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, she's amazing in this
totally
movie.
In it, yeah.
And just the way that she holds her body and the way she looks and the way that she smiles while crying and, like, conveys the realism of you're hurt so bad, but there's nothing you can do about it. So you have to just keep going.
Smile and keep going.
Because there's absolutely nothing. And I just, I'm brokenhearted because, you know, like you're asked, Ashley, you know, you ask, like, what would you be thinking when you were watching this movie when you were in 01? And I'm thinking about every person I liked who was never going to like me back. You know, everyone who, you know, that's when you're William, you're thinking of what you want and you're not getting because they just don't see you because they're always looking at somebody mm-hmm. else kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so that's completely, you know, connecting to William in that sense because you always feel like you're on the outside and other people always seem to be having the fun or getting what you want or having the person you like them, even when that person happens to be a colossal asshole, and in this case, like a predator.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And still, they're viewed as better than you, and they want you more, even no matter how nice you are or how you're always there, because that's, for some reason, not what some people want. They don't want nice. They want sparks.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't control sparks.
Oh.
But you don't know that when you're a teenager because you what you see in movies are the sparks all the time. And then you wonder, well, where the fuck are my sparks?
Speaking of sparks, when everybody sees Penny walk into that reception.
Oh.
Like,
oh,
and
who's she with?
Everybody was just like, she's with me.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. I feel so bad for his wife or girlfriend or whoever she is. Like, that would suck.
Yeah.
I feel bad for her. When you find out information later that makes you feel less bad for her. But then also, like, you wonder at that situation for everyone. Because she knows for a fact that he is cheating on her in every single city. And she just doesn't want to know about it in her city.
Like
and like, why does she want to be with him? Like, I'm not like shaming her at all. He's a complete asshole. I don't like him at all. But why does she like him? Why is she putting up with that?
Because he's a big rock star. Makes lots of money.
Is that fucking what it is? I mean, Penny wants to put up with it. And then she wants to put up with it. Because wrestle some fucking golden god.
Yeah. Because he's, you know, famous. He's a rock star. He's mysterious and dark.
It's the stash. You know?
Yeah. It's that. Fuck, I guess. That stash.
No thanks.
But yeah, that, no, not live. Nope. No, but yeah, that scene when she walks in and they have to go talk to her and you see her reacting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, and William sees it too. And that's, and he's really, because of their treatment of Penny, he starts to see them for who they are. I mean, he's not really seeing, because Russell treats him like shit. And it's only really when Russell's treating Penny like shit that it sparks him to realize who the band really is. But he still has to, a job to do. So even after he saves Penny, he still has to go.
Right.
Flying to a gig the following day, the plane encounters severe weather. Fearing the plane will crash, everyone confesses their secrets while Jeff and Russell's long simmering conflicts erupt. William confesses his love for Penny after Jeff insults her. The plane lands safely in Tupelo, leaving everyone to ponder the changed atmosphere. William arrives at the Rolling Stone office in San Francisco, but has difficulty finishing the article. Seeking help, he calls Lester Bangs, who says that William got caught up in being part of the band. He says his perceived friendships with them are not real and advises him to be honest and unmerciful. Rolling Stone's editors rave over William's completed article, but when the magazine's fact checker calls the band, Russell lies to protect Stillwater's image and claims most of it is false. Rolling Stone kills the article, crushing William. Anita encounters a dejected William in the airport and offers to take him anywhere. He chooses for them to go to their home in San Diego.
Okay. Man, the fucking plane scene.
That was my favorite scene in this whole movie.
Yeah.
They're all yelling confessions at each other.
Yep. I agree.
Just, you know, in the moment of death, they had to get it all out.
Mm-hmm. I know. I'm like, what would I say?
I mean, I hope that's not that you ran over someone.
I mean, I've never run over anybody.
Not that you would, you know, say it on the podcast now. But, like, no. That was, how do you come back from that? Everything else.
Right, yeah. Everything else, yeah. But
everything else, but you. But then I also do want to note that they definitely played up the guy saying he's gay right as everything levels out. Almost like that's the worst thing that could possibly be said. And then the most awkward afterwards.
Right. Because then immediately afterwards, he was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
And I hope that was they treated him well after that.
What?
I hope they treated him well after that.
Well, they never really make reference to it. You know, you'd think that maybe in the next year they might like show like a male groupie or something, or maybe he would have like rainbowed something out or whatever. But yeah, it's just it probably eerily they just probably forgot about it. Like he probably stopped and didn't mention it again. Just like they didn't mention Dennis killing someone.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure they probably mentioned Jeff sleeping with, what's her name? Russell's woman. Because they slept together. Leslie.
Oh, yeah. I forgot.
Because they confessed that they slept together.
Mm-hmm.
I think she also slept with another band member. The other guy. Yep. I can't remember.
But that
his
was
name.
When they were trying that one thing, so it didn't count.
Yeah. they land and William throws up. And then I always love that he runs to catch back up and walk to the front. Like he walks through everybody to get back to the front. And I just feel like I don't know what the symbolism of that is.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't stay behind. Like he's one of them now. He's gone through that. And then to have Russell completely just pull it out from under him. Because they're
maybe
scared.
Just that, like, they just really won't wait for him. Like, they don't care enough about him. Like,
well, no, because they think that his words are going to ruin their upward momentum of their career. Like, even though it's going to be Rolling Stone and they're on the cover, they're going to give that up because of how they're going to look. And I love they're going through it. And like Jeff says all of the stuff that he says he doesn't say it.
Yeah.
And because it's like you're painting him exactly how you are. And then Russell's like, I never said I'm a golden god. Or did I?
Yeah. Like, how would you know? You were high out of your mind.
Exactly. What was it? It was LSD. Was it acid in the beer?
It was acid beer.
Yeah, I've never had acid beer. I'm sure that I might scream I'm a golden god as well. Hopefully there would be water under me if I jumped.
I would die, yeah.
Probably, yes, you would definitely die.
No acid for you.
No acid for you.
Come back. Don't do drugs.
Thank you, McGruff. So then he randomly meets Anita, and she's a flight attendant, and she looks so cute.
She looks happy.
Yeah. And go anywhere, and he tricks her.
Yeah, what the heck, dude?
Well, because that's Cameron Crowe is his wish. He wanted his real mom and real sister to reconcile, and they never did until he wrote this movie, and then they did.
Aww.
Aww.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So he wrote the ending that he wanted. He wished they would have done it a much, much sooner, but ultimately they did it. So he brings them back together. And yeah, and things are kind of happy, but not at the end when you're thinking, okay, he's not going to get it published.
Band-Aid Sapphire chastises Russell for betraying William. He then calls Penny, wanting to meet with her, but she gives him William's address. He arrives and finds himself face-to-face with William's mother, who, during the tour, scolded him over the phone for his behavior. Russell apologizes to William and finally gives him an interview. Russell has verified William's article to Rolling Stone, which runs it as a cover feature. Penny fulfills her long-standing fantasy to go to Morocco while Stillwater tours again by bus.
No more airplanes. No more planes tour.
Nope.
What did they name the bus?
Oh, fuck. What is it?
No, I forgot.
Shit.
Was it Fran?
It's not shit. Man, that's a piece of information that I did not. I want to say it's. I have no idea. I have no guesses.
Aww. Peggy.
Yes, it's definitely Peggy. You got it. So I guess Russell he gets them to write the article and doesn't end up with Penny. So he's supposed to be like okay now. I mean, still like he thought he was going to Penny's house. Like, I feel like it was like, what's that To Catch a Predator show?
Oh yeah.
With what's his name? Where you're like, here's the address, show up. And then like,
yeah, I can't remember the guy's name, but they ambush people.
And then Russell opens the door and it's the mom instead. He's like, I thought, what happened, Penny? What happened to you? Like, did you think you were going to meet a 16-year-old girl?
I'm just glad that she was like, you know what? I'm done with you.
Yes. That's totally empowering. Which maybe then, so like I said before, are we supposed to believe the whole time that she was in power and she just fell in love? I mean, love doesn't only emasculate masculine men. I mean, love makes you do the wonky. Love messes everybody up. Even the strongest of people. So she really, like, loved Russell?
I don't know.
So she was still just weak, no strength, no...
I don't... If someone treats you like fucking shit over and over and over and over and over again like that, I have no sympathy whatsoever if you stay with that person. I'm sorry. I can't. Yeah.
Well, but she decided to leave. I mean, she saw, after a while, I think, the toxicity of him.
Yeah, but that's only when he drove her to a point where she thought that she needed to die, and I think that's unacceptable.
Yeah, and then after that, it was Sapphire saying, like, even Penny knows what you did to William.
Yeah.
So exactly. She then noticed the disregard that Russell had for her and then what Russell had for William. So both Russell and Penny had their eyes opened to the treatment of other people by the treatment of themselves.
And I don't think that Penny could look at her, like her and Russell's relationship through the lens of, I'm his inspiration. Like, I'm supporting them because, like you said, Sarah, he just treated her like shit to the point that she didn't want to be here anymore.
Yeah. Right. So then what does it say? I'm sorry, Sarah, go ahead.
That wasn't me.
Like, you can't just treat people like that and expect them to want to stay around you.
So what does that say then that at the end, William's still interviewing Russell? Like, the film ends on Russell. Like, he's a good guy or something.
Yeah.
Like, the final prize at the end of the movie is getting an interview with him. Like, it doesn't end with William and Penny. It ends with Penny going off on her own. So then, like, that's weird, right?
Yeah.
Like, well, I'm not saying that, like, they had to get together. I mean, they're fucking teenagers. It's not like you get married then. I mean, but, like, it's really weird that William's happy ending was interviewing an asshole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Penny got to go and be free.
I think William got the career that he always wanted. Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty big perk, but.
What'd you say, Ashley?
I was just saying the same. I think that he just was getting the career that he always wanted. And that's why it was a big deal for William.
But still, the interview at the end was also still a big deal for him. He didn't learn anything about Russell. He's still charmed. He still sees sitting down and talking to this asshole, the guy who kept having sex with the girl that he wanted, kept treating him like shit, treating everyone else like shit. He still wanted the interview. He still wanted the guy's time. That's like abusive situation.
And to me, what I thought was weird was that he actually wanted like the interview because he loves this woman, right? And this guy almost fucking kills her because she wanted to die. And then you want to be in the same room as this man that almost killed the person you love?
Like, exactly.
Like, how can you sit there and ask him questions and be totally chill when he almost ruined someone's life?
I mean, is that's the power of celebrity? I mean, people are always going to listen to Michael Jackson music. Are people always going to watch reruns of The Cosby Show?
Well, I mean, it's just until recently that things were pushed under the rug all of the time for celebrities. I mean, only now are things being...
The cancel culture a thing where you don't... But yeah, it's almost like all of the bad that he did is now erased because he's a celebrity. I mean, O.J. Simpson got away with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, people didn't believe you could do anything wrong. Like, I remember watching, you know, all of that kind of this trial and everything, and people just didn't believe that he could have done anything wrong.
Because if you presented yourself in a certain way, then people don't believe what it is behind the doors. And celebrities know a lot about that. And it just strikes me at the end how we're just supposed to forget all of this shit and bad. And just focus on Russell at the end. And I'm just like, eh.
Well, I guess it also Polexia has something.
Instead, you know?
Yeah.
I want to read a book that Polexia writes more than a book that Russell writes. Polexia, the one who ran into the wall.
Hmm.
That's Sapphire. Polexia is Anna Paquin.
Yeah.
Either one of those people, I'll read their books.
Yeah.
And Jeff Beebe. I'll read Jeff Beebe's book. Is that Almost Famous?
That is.
That is Almost Famous. It's snowflake time.
It's snowflake time.
We need like some sort of awesome music. And then like it's snowflake time. Like some kind of thing. All right, where are we heading? How trigger you had oh my god. I don't want to ruin this movie. Track. Oh my god.
Guys. I ranted so hard about this romance scene. I have to give it a 4.
Oh shit.
I don't even know how do you tell someone it's a really awesome movie. You just have to deal with statutory rape.
Yes.
how do you
it's grooming not, being it's glorified. Like
statutory rape.
Yeah, I don't know.
Kidnapping, that's, technically.
Yeah. That's where we come to. It's always such a hard decision to make when saying these kinds of things. Because, like, there are definitely people you wouldn't recommend this movie to, and there are people who you would. But, anyways, getting ahead of myself.
It's so fucking strange because, like, I didn't even think about that with this movie. Like, Almost Famous, I think about it as William and The Journey, and then all of a sudden you're watching and you're like, oh my god, wait a minute, 15.
Yeah.
And now you're like, he's like 27.
Right.
And you're like, then you're kind of out of the movie for a second.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like, it is striking that there was a time where you're like, you just glossed over that. You're like, this fact doesn't matter.
Yeah, or
R. Kelly's like, yay. Like,
yeah, brains are like acceptable.
And so now you really can't. And that really fucking bothers me because like you have to just be like, this is one of these cultural facts that we acknowledge. This was the way people thought.
Well, I mean,
but does it
to an extent
ruin the whole movie?
I don't know that it ruins the whole movie. It was a big kind of like, why did I not notice that before sort of thing. And like that took me out of the movie.
I honestly think it's a much bigger trigger because of how they don't resolve it and they still glorify and idolize Russell.
Yeah.
Even though Penny leaves him, there isn't any kind of karmic punishment for Russell.
Right.
He gets away with everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that.
Yeah, and then he gets more famous.
Exactly. Because of William and after he treated him like that. So I feel like I don't know, maybe it does have to be something like a 4. I could see something of saying like, okay, it's a little triggering, but you'll get through it because maybe then in the end, there's something that happens with Russell where he acknowledges the wrong. But there wasn't any of that.
No. There were no apologies. Yeah. Like, no apologies for any of the problematic things that they did or said.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, then they didn't get the guy for the hit and run. They didn't, like, say anything about selling people for, you know, $50. Nothing happened to any of the people. Well,
I mean,
William
was pissed. I mean, that was a noticeably wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think
it did still get done.
Yeah. I think
she was hurt by it.
I think I'll have to go with 3 where I'm good for social change. I didn't rant about it. I probably wouldn't have ranted about it. And I don't think podcasting counts as ranting about it because it's a podcast, damn it. But I think I'd give 3 because social change would dictate that you would not have that fact in a movie anymore. You wouldn't just randomly have that age gap relationship without it being pivotal to the movie and then fixed. I mean, this was pivotal to the movie, but it wasn't fixed. Like, they didn't say loudly enough that Russell's a bad person.
Right.
So I think a 3.
Yeah. I did not rant about this movie. I'm just not a person who does that. I'm just like, I don't care. Like, I'm not going to rant about a movie to somebody just because I wouldn't. But I was thinking like 3.5 because I don't think that – I really don't think that I would give it a 4. But it can't sit at a 3 either.
Okay.
So – because it is, there's so many triggers and some of them are just bad.
They're really, bad. Really, really bad. But
my snowflake rating does not, and the recommendation do not equate. So they don't have to be the same thing.
So you'd be like, still watch this, but be prepared.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'd be the same thing. I would say to watch it, but yeah.
But that there are some things in it, yeah. But I mean, like, I remember liking this movie, and I do like this movie, but those moments, they do take away from the movie, and they do take you out of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate.
Sarah?
I wouldn't go so far as to give it a 4. I'll give it a 3. The suicide, just all of it.
Just all of it.
It was.
But do you recommend?
I enjoyed parts of this movie, and then when it got closer to the ending, I was like, okay, so maybe not. So I don't think that I would, just because I wouldn't rewatch this movie.
Okay.
That's a good guy.
But I still liked parts of it. Like, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't my favorite either.
Okay.
Ashley, with a 4 snowflake, does it get a recommend?
That's a great question. I don't think I'll watch it again. Here's the thing. I liked parts of this movie. I just wish that it was a little bit different. Like, I really like the step back in time. I really like the soundtrack. I really like the idea of, you know, like, memorializing your young rise to rock star, you know,
mm-hmm.
writing, like, for Rolling Stone. I mean, like, it's still really big today. That's a dream for a lot of people. But, like, why did it have to be like that?
Maybe it's one where watching it immediately, maybe you guys were like so triggered and so full of thought that, like, watching it again, maybe you'd be able to digest something else. I mean, because I don't know if I'm trying to stick up for it, because I am so bummed, because I love all of the scenes with Frances McDormand, with Elaine, and I love Lester Bangs talking about music and the coming of age stuff. And I really hate to see all of that just thrown away because of the asshole who I don't like anyway. But there are people like that. I don't feel like they dealt with it in a good enough way. But I don't know if it's one that you say you don't want to rewatch, and that's a signal that you need to.
Meh.
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 I'm going to say I don't recommend officially.
All right, so 2-2. A polarizing Almost Famous, a great way to end our summer of sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Now you have to connect it to Buffy.
Oh, yeah, I'll connect it to Buffy. I don't think I made any notes or wrote anything down about how to connect it to Buffy, but I most definitely can. I mean, I don't want to go like Fairuza Balk was in The Craft with Neve Campbell, and Neve Campbell was in Scream 2 with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Why don't you want to?
Because I feel like I do that all the time. Like, it's always like, oh, Sarah Michelle Gellar was in Scream 2 or something like that. But I don't know. I don't always go back and listen to how I've connected it. I just make my note connected and go on. So I might do a different one, or I might keep it the same. I don't know how you'll ever know.
You'll see it on Facebook at Millennial Movie Mix.
Wait, hold on. I don't think that we previewed our next week episode.
Well, huh? Yeah, Sarah is locked and loaded to tell us what it is.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. I forgot what we're doing here.
We're ending out the podcast, Ashley.
Oh, my gosh. Back to school is crazy.
Sarah, why don't you go ahead and give us what that is?
We're going to be doing Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone from 2001.
Why would we be doing Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone?
It's back to school.
Back to school.
Back to school.
I feel like that's a Grease 2 song. Or is that Grease? Is it Back to School Again?
Not Grease.
It's got to be Grease too. See, it's got to be the better one. That's what I remember. All right. Well, you come back next Monday. We are going to get magical with Harry Potter. And thank you for listening.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.